As we enter day 20 of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there has been more shelling of residential buildings in the capital city of Kyiv. Lindsay Hilsum is international editor with Channel 4 News, and she joins us from there now. Lindsay, can you tell us firstly what the situation is like where you are this morning?
Well, it's a bright sunny day and it looks lovely outside of the hotel, but you know what? It's not really lovely. Last night we were woken at around 5 o'clock by several explosions, and this was artillery which came into several places just near us, and these were apartment blocks. And one of the things that you begin to realize here is that residential areas are being targeted. It happened the day before as well. We met a family who were from a place called Obolon, that's in the north of Kyiv. The apartment block next to theirs had been hit overnight. Two people were killed and several were injured. And this family, it was a mother, a daughter, and a few younger children as well. And they just said, you know, for 19 days, we've been on the run, going from this place to that place, trying to avoid this shelling and this horror. And they just couldn't take it anymore, and they were at the station trying to get a train to take them to the west, to Poland. They were absolutely terrified with their nerves on edge. And that's what's happening all round the suburbs of this city.
So in the suburbs, life is intolerable and the people are exhausted.
Absolutely. In Erpin, which is it's a sort of like a dormitory town, I suppose you'd call it, to the northwest. It's been pretty much destroyed. And that's a place which was, there were 70,000 people living there. It was a pretty nice suburb. I know somebody who lived there. It was a middle-class suburb. We were driving towards there the other day, and one of the people I work with, one of the Ukrainians, said, you know, my daughter used to go to school along this road. And you just think of it now. The road was pretty much deserted. When we got to the last checkpoint before the bridge into Erpin, we came under quite sustained artillery fire. And that's what it's like for the people there all the time. We just had 10 minutes of it. They've now had 19 days of it. And there are only about 10,000 people of the 70,000 people left in Erpin now. And It's a wasteland. Their apartment blocks are destroyed. Those who can't get out for whatever reason are just in basements. And the mayor of Erpin said that only 70% of the suburb is still in Ukrainian hands, that about 30% is now controlled by the Russians.
We hear about the difficulties for people who are still trying to leave places like Mariupol in the south. Are there humanitarian corridors open around Kyiv, around those suburbs? Can people still leave?
It's pretty patchy. Obviously, Mariupol seems to be the worst in terms of a humanitarian disaster. And also, you know, in the difficulty people have had in leaving. But I met some women from a village called Peremoha yesterday. Now, that is northwest of Kyiv, up towards a place called Chernihiv. And they were telling me about how it's really 2 weeks that the Russians have been occupying their village. And those were pretty terrifying 2 weeks for them, with these Russian soldiers with their machine guns patrolling. They said for 3 days they couldn't get out of the house at all. They were too terrified. Then they were allowed to go out and just to feed the animals. And they were desperate to leave. And then they were told that there was what they call a green corridor. This was, I suppose, 4 days ago now. And some families did try to leave, but they were shot as they were leaving. One assumes that they were shot by the Russians, although we don't know that for sure. But there was no, the villagers didn't know what to do. They couldn't get out because the situation was so terrifying. This woman told me that they couldn't even bury the bodies. And then finally yesterday, she and her family decided to make a run for it, that they were told it would be safe. And we met them at the station and they were still trembling in terror, because they had no idea whether it really would be safe for them to leave or not.
Desperate situation. When you talk about Russian occupation of these villages, are we to read into that that the Ukrainian forces cannot or have decided to stop trying to defend those areas now, that that battle has been lost?
I find that really hard to judge. Certainly, In the areas I've been around Kyiv, northeast, northwest, the Ukrainians are holding on. They are fighting back. They are sometimes taking the fight to the Russians. In the firefight we were in, I heard outgoing before I heard incoming, if you see what I mean. So it was as if the Ukrainians were trying to push the Russians back. But certainly they are outgunned. And also the Russian tactics, they can't just come rolling down into Kyiv as we think that they had wanted to do, you know, just have a short and victorious war, as Tsar Nicholas II once talked about. They didn't manage to do that, but they are terrorizing this place. And it's very difficult to defend a city against arbitrary artillery that comes in and destroys people's homes. So the Ukrainians are very mobile with their infantry, and they are able to creep through the forests in small units, and they have had some success in destroying tank columns. They've done it very professionally. They take out the tank at the front and then the tank at the back. And they're still continuing to do that. But that is not, in the end, a way. You can't stop massive artillery into residential areas with small mobile units of people equipped with anti-tank weapons.
We spoke about Mariupol and the humanitarian situation there. We know it's absolutely desperate, but do you think that that situation now is beginning to be replicated where you are to some extent? Given what you've just described there about life in the suburbs, is it now becoming an issue to get food, to get water, to get basic supplies?
I think it is, certainly in places like Pin and Bucha, these satellite and dormitory towns to the northwest. And I think it will become like that in place called Brovary, which is in the northeast. One of the things that we saw the other day was a food warehouse which had been hit by artillery. And I thought, oh, was that a mistake? And then I realized I'd seen a food warehouse that had been hit in Mykolaiv as well, which is one of the Black Sea ports where I was last week. And then I began to think, maybe the Russians are targeting civilian food supplies, because that would, you know, that would be another tactic. It's, you know, if that is what they're doing, it's a war crime. But it's certainly a tactic that they used in Syria, where they destroyed crops in the field and they destroyed silos of grain. So I don't think that there is a food shortage in Kyiv at the moment. I've also been to a supermarket which was pretty well stocked, and you've got a road in from the south which is still clear, which people, supplies can come in and people can go out. So as yet in the center of Kyiv, no, I don't see food shortages and so on, but certainly in those small towns, you know, northwest, north and northeast, you're certainly beginning to get that. And that, I think, is, it's a tactic. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to terrorize and starve the people out. Because if they want to take Kyiv, the city, obviously it's much easier to do that if there's very few people here.
We have this extraordinary visit today from the leaders of Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, heading straight into a war zone. And the aim there, I assume, Lindsay, is to show solidarity.
I assume, and I have to say, in my years of reporting, which are probably more than I would like to say, I've never come across that before, of world leaders actually heading into a war zone like this. So it's pretty brave of them. And I think it also shows how powerful the image of President Zelensky is, and how, you know, despite the Americans saying that they would help him, you know, leave and go somewhere safe, he refused to do that. You know, famously at the beginning of the war, he said, "I need ammunition, not a ride." And I think that the visit of these European leaders shows that Europe wants to very much show solidarity with him. But having said that, I was talking to an MP, a member of parliament, the other day, who helped us get up towards the front line. And he said, you know, all of this stuff is great, but what we need is more weapons.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, the courage of President Zelensky appears to be infectious.
Oh, it really is. And it's tremendously important to people in Ukraine as well. You know, it's interesting that everybody says, oh, you know, he's a comedian, he's an actor, he's not really the kind of chap you need to lead in a war. But in a modern war, actually, those images and the way he and his team put together scenes of him in Kiev. The other day, walking along with a couple of his aides, drinking coffee in the street. They'd just got themselves some lattes. I mean, that kind of image is tremendously powerful, particularly to younger people in Ukraine. And it's certainly soldiers I've spoken to find him very inspiring. But I think that the issue is, how long can that last? Because, David and Goliath, we love the story of David and Goliath, but usually David doesn't win. Normally it's Goliath.
Lindsay, thank you so much for talking to us once again.
You're welcome.
Now, John Everard is former British ambassador to Belarus, and he joins me on the line now. John, thanks very much for being with us again. I want to talk to you first about that news about Marina Osinnikova, an editor on Channel One, Russia's state TV. She has been detained for an anti-war protest after this happened last night.
Говорил сегодня Михаил Мишустин. На встрече со своим белорусским коллегой российский премьер подчеркнул, надо усилить сотрудничество в рамках союзного государства, а на совещании в правительстве обсуждали, как сохранить доход.
So there you see, news presenter on Russia State TV being interrupted by an editor at that station who was holding up a sign saying there is no war, they're lying to you. Now, there are reports this morning, John, that she is facing a pre-investigation review by the station, by Channel One. What might that mean?
It means effectively that the Russian state prosecutors want to play this slow. They're in a bit of a bind. As you know, there are draconian laws now in Russia against anybody who denies the Russian version of events in Ukraine. But to apply those laws, they have to bring her to court. And in any Russian court, there is some degree of transparency. Now, she's become a national figure, and I think they'll be a bit shy about putting her in front of a court with any kind of public gallery. So I suspect we'll see a pre-investigation, an investigation, a pre-trial detention while they try and work out what to do.
I know from our previous chats that you keep a close eye on Russian state television. You listen to the radio there as well. What's the level of awareness, do you think, given what's being broadcast about the war amongst Russians?
The level of awareness amongst those who want to find out about it is probably quite high, although Putin's team have tried very hard to close off all channels of communication. Quite a lot does get through. Quite detailed reports, for example, on the sanctions, on the fact that Putin himself was being sanctioned. There was a good report on the UN vote against Russia. Not very much from what is actually happening in Ukraine. That's just too difficult for stations to handle. But there is quite a lot coming through into Russia from relatives in Ukraine and people on the ground there. But a lot of Russians, you have to remember, just don't want to know. They're quite happy to lap up what the Kremlin serves them and believe that this is a war of liberation fought against crypto-fascists who have taken over a brother Slav state.
Now, China's next move is critical, and everybody is watching to see what China will do next. America and China had their first high-level in-person talks since the invasion began. What's your assessment of what might happen there, John?
I don't know, and I'm pretty sure that Xi Jinping himself doesn't know. This Chinese statement after the talks, which I noticed was read out, there's no impromptu talking at all, was very carefully worded. The Chinese are keeping all their options open. They hate being forced into decisions, and they will wait until the very last moment before they decide which way to jump. So they say, on the one hand, yes, they fully respect the sovereignty of Ukraine, but they very carefully leave open the door to military supplies to Russia at a later date, if need be. Now, one point that's always getting lost in the noise is that China never does anything for free. If the Russians are forced to ask China for military supplies and the Chinese agree, they will exact a price for that that will make Vladimir Putin weep.
And the Americans saying that China is very much open to helping Russia in the war. And interestingly, we heard last night that the Americans say that the Russians had asked for very basic supplies like food for troops.
Yes, we all thought that the Russian problem was logistics on the ground, actually getting supplies through to frontline units. But it turns out, no, they are basically short of food, of surface-to-air missiles, the R-42 apparently, things we thought the Russians had in plentiful supply. Apparently not. What a shock.
John, it's always good to talk to you, and we'll catch up again soon, no doubt. That's John Everard there. Now, Vice Admiral Mark Mellett is the former head of the Defence Forces, and he joins me now in the studio. Mark, you're very welcome to the programme today, and it's really interesting to get your perspective on what's happening now in Ukraine. You've over 39 years' experience, and you've been to places like Lebanon and Afghanistan. Did you foresee a Russian invasion of Ukraine on the scale that we're witnessing today?
No, I did not. And I think very few analysts really saw it, despite the, I suppose, the sense coming from the US that it looked that way. The reality is that Europe has had an extraordinary period of peace for nearly 75 years since the Second World War. And that was built on initiatives such as Robert Schuman, the development of the European community and the European Union. But it was also built on the back of support from the US in the context of the Marshall Plan reconstruction of Europe after the Second World War. And notwithstanding the Balkan Wars, which were horrific in their own way, Europe has been peaceful and stable. But what's happened, I think, in the last decade or so, there has been kind of an inversion of power. And I often say that's associated with social media, that has actually, to some degree, been weaponized by some states. And one in particular is the Russian Federation. At the same time, you have a regression from the principle of multilateralism, which underpinned that peace and security in Europe. Mm-hmm. A regression you could see with regards to the United States beginning to take a more unilateral approach, pivoting towards Asia. And Europe was kind of squeezed between China and the US, with a Russia that was becoming more emboldened, in particular because of its apparent interventions in Syria, its interventions in terms of Nagorno-Karabakh, its more recent intervention in Kazakhstan, its invasion of Georgia in 2008. And its annexation of Crimea.
So there were signs along the way, but no one expected it to get as far as it did. Just on that word emboldened, and I know you've been watching this situation very closely when it comes to Ireland and Russia's influence here. Have we been too naive on that front, Mark?
I think most European states have been too naive. I think that weaponization or that inversion of power using cyber, using a hybrid. And I have called that supposed exercise off the southwest coast where Russia indicated wanted to annex effectively for 5 days an area the size of Wexford, Wicklow and Dublin. In our sovereign jurisdiction, it was provocative. It was unprecedented. And it really, at the end of the day, when it may go away because of an intervention from our fishermen, that was classic hybrid. It was
explain that to me now, because that's very interesting that you say that. And most of us wouldn't understand classic hybrid because that's a military term. What does all of that mean?
For Russia to become stronger, all it needs to do is make Europe look weaker. So if it can make the institutions in our states look weak, in this particular case, it endeavoured to show that our government was not able to do anything about this exercise, and yet the fishermen could. It tried to demonstrate that the government was weak and didn't have power. And that's really what the messaging from Russia is, to try and weaken the institutions in the European Union. And that, therefore, makes it appear stronger, relatively speaking. And that's the game that has happened. And we've seen this in the context of interfering with democratic institutions in terms of elections, probably in the US presidential election, probably in the case of Brexit, the use of cyber, the use of influencing public opinion, the use of social media. It is quite apparent that Russia's interests are certainly not aligned with those of Europe. And it is looking at the future in the context of the opportunity presented now with the pivot of US towards. Mm-hmm.
Coming back to the Irish example as well, in 2020, Russia lodged plans to extend the Russian embassy. And we know that caused concern in military and government circles. Why?
Well, I think the ambition of those plans was extraordinary in terms of a small country like Ireland, the size of the development. And I think the government made a very bold decision in terms of restricting that planning. And I know that's up for review, and it's a matter that I can't really talk about here. But it is certainly the size of the installation on Orwell Road was not a requirement for a small state like Ireland in terms of the linkages with Russia. And I think there's a genuine concern that what was being constructed was not about bilateral relations between Ireland and Russia, but perhaps a facility that had other purposes.
Mm-hmm. And it was a huge facility. I'm looking at the drawing of it here now. It would have 8 self-contained 2-bedroom units, underground parking for 23 cars, an ESB substation to meet the compound's increased power requirements. I think everybody was asking at the time, weren't they? Why is this needed here? What's it for?
Well, I think the challenge is that Ireland really needs to look at its position in the context of the multilateralism. Ireland doesn't exist in a silo on its own. It's connected with its partners in Europe, the 27 members of the EU, and also its relationship and bilateral relationship with Great Britain and UK. And I think that facility certainly was not about bilateral relations with Ireland. It was also, I think, a much broader play in the context mm-hmm. of its utility for operations, hybrid, perhaps cyber, intelligence collection and others.
When we were discussing the plan to have the exercises, the military exercises off the southwest coast, many commentators said, look, we are in a very strategic geographical position on the world map. Do you agree with that, Mark, that for the Russians, when you look at where Ireland is, we're very strategic for them?
Well, I described ourselves as the lonely sentinel on the Western approaches to the EU, and that's where we are now post-Brexit. We're to some degree isolated from the other 26. We have UK between ourselves and mainland Europe. And at the same time, we have a huge jurisdiction of almost 1 million square kilometres where the state has sovereignty or sovereign rights over seabed, subseabed, and resources in the water column. And strangely, in a kind of an opportunity, there's a huge opportunity for Ireland in the context of its offshore renewable energy development. And looking at Europe and the difficult position it's in, I think in 2016, the Council conclusions spoke about the need to have strategic autonomy. That's the ability to act unilaterally when necessary, but with partners when possible. And that has moved on to the point whereby it's now recognised that EU cannot have strategic autonomy until it has energy self-sufficiency.
And stops this reliance on fossil fuels from Russia.
40% of our LNG comes from Russia, 30% of our crude comes from Russia. So there is a huge dependency there.
Mm-hmm.
So the potential in terms of offshore renewable energy, in terms of fixed wind, floating wind, is extraordinary. And the development of other vectors such as green hydrogen would give Europe that strategic autonomy. And Ireland could play a major role in that. And it also serves the more, existential problem of climate change. We need to move towards net zero by 2050 and 51%.
And going back to your analogy of the lone sentinel, what is your assessment of these conversations we've been hearing around Ireland's neutrality? You know, whether we should be having a conversation now. Some people have suggested that perhaps this should lead to a referendum. We should be talking about this on the national stage, perhaps having a civic society conversation around it. Do you think we should? Is the time right?
I would be worried that it would be polarising. I think it's much better for us to work the institutions of the EU, the permanent structured cooperation, the coordinated annual review mechanism of defence. Our platforms are there within the EU, and Ireland has an opportunity to play its part mm-hmm. through those.
But even within the EU, there's a conversation, isn't there, about a common defence strategy?
And in fact, if we were to look at what the invasion of Ukraine has done, it has solidified NATO. It has emboldened countries like Germany, which has significantly committed to increasing its defence spending. It has raised questions in neutrals such as Sweden and Finland, who are now looking in terms of where the future is. So I suppose from my point of view, ultimately, this is a political question. But I think that within the institutions of the 27, there is a few miles Ireland needs to go in terms of being an actor in the context of its engagement on, the principles that actually underpin this multilateralism.
Before we finish, I want to ask you about your new role as Ambassador for National Flag Day. This is tomorrow, isn't it?
The 16th of March is the National Flag Day, and the Thomas Francis Maher Foundation, it's a remarkable institution. It really has been built on the fact that next year will be the 175th anniversary of the flying of the tricolour, the first time in Ireland, on 33 de Mall in Waterford. Thomas Francis Maher, I suppose, set the path towards what we now hold today as our flag, our national colours. It's a symbol of unity. If one, I suppose, emblem represents our sovereignty, it's the flag of a nation. And we see that in the context of the Ukraine, whereby the yellow and blue of Ukraine is everywhere. I just came back from Poland at the weekend, and everywhere throughout Poland, you could not help but see the Ukrainian flag. People gathering together in unity with that symbolism of the flag. And I met a number of people coming back from Poland on Sunday night, mainly women and children who are refugees now, and they all were carrying the Ukrainian flag. So for us, Thomas Francis Maher aims to actually, I suppose, instill a debate in our secondary schools with regards to the importance of the flag, but also to show the flag as a unifying and, I suppose, an inclusive emblem. And it's just wonderful to see some of the stories there, like the children of the flag from Nagel Community School in Cork, who were the overall winners with the song that they wrote, but also the likes of a beautiful poem by Amy Walsh in from St Mary's College in Naas. And if I could just read
Short, nice way to finish.
Yeah, the flag cannot see background. It always accepts your fate. There is not a single bound to the connection the flag creates. They travel through our rivers and walk along our streets, a message of hope it delivers with acceptance to those it meets. So it's about inclusivity and it's about diversity. And I think it's about unifying the diversity in our society, in culture, creed, ethnicity, gender and sexual orientation.
Okay. Mark, we'll leave it there, but thank you very much indeed. National Flag Day is tomorrow and you're the ambassador for that. But for now, thank you very much for joining us.
Claire, thank you very much.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.